The Kingdom of Ai, Chapter 19, The Valley of Misery. Ruin and misery characterized their lives. As the group filed back into the bunkhouse to retire for the evening, Stephen tapped Thomas on the shoulder. "Can you and David sit and talk for a few minutes? I wanted to ask you something." "Sure, what's up?" Thomas asked. Timothy joined Stephen as he motioned for the brothers to head toward the seating area in front of the fireplace. As the four settled into the comfortable leather furniture, Stephen began, "I know that both of you love the beauty of this place and have mentioned you would love to stay here. We just wanted to make sure you are still with us and plan to continue on the journey tomorrow." The brothers looked at each other and chuckled at the question. "You seem to have forgotten that it was just a few nights ago in Ambition that we were worried about you not continuing," Thomas said. "I know, you're right. It was a temptation I had to fight through," Stephen conceded. "And you are right. We love the beauty in Natureville," David admitted, "and it has tempted us to stay here." "And us too," chimed in Ben, who had been standing by the door of the men's bunk room but listening to the conversation. Timothy turned to Ben and Ray and motioned for them to join the powwow at the fireplace. "Have you made a decision?" Stephen asked. "We have. We are sticking with the journey to the City of Grace," Thomas said without hesitation. "So are we," said Ben. Stephen looked at the earnest faces of the brothers, thinking of how far they had come. "I am so glad," he said, with obvious relief in his voice. "What made you decide to continue?" Timothy asked. Just at that moment, there was a knock on the door. Ray jumped up to answer it. The wooden door creaked as it swung open, and to everyone's surprise, there stood Andrew the Encourager. "Andrew," the young men gasped, "come in." At the sound of the commotion, the others emerged from the bunk rooms until the whole group was crowded around their trusted friend. After much handshaking and backslapping, the group settled down in front of the fireplace. "I believe you have all found Natureville to be quite pleasant," Andrew said with a knowing smile, "to the extent that some of you were tempted to remain here. So what changed your minds?" There was a moment of awkward silence, but then David spoke up. "You're right, Andrew. My brother and I were very tempted to stay here in Natureville because it feels so incredibly peaceful and it is so beautiful. To be honest, I planned to talk to Mr. Woods about staying behind when everyone left. That is, until we got to the top of Green Mountain. When I saw those altars to the different animals, it really bothered me. I realized it wasn't much different from worshiping the Isle of Mammon back in our hometown, so I knew at that moment I couldn't stay here." "I made my decision at the top of Green Mountain too," his brother Thomas said, "but for a different reason. When Mr. Woods told us about his dream and how the king asked him why he was worshiping the creation instead of the creator, I felt like he was asking me the same question. Then and there I knew I could not choose Natureville over seeking the king." "Okay, I had that exact same thought," exclaimed Ben. "I felt like the king was talking to me when Mr. Woods shared his dream." "And what about you, Ray?" Andrew asked. Ray squirmed as the focus of the group shifted to him. With an embarrassed smile, he said, "I was really wanting to stay here. But tonight, when Mrs. Woods was talking to us at the dinner table, I realized that the two people who have lived in Natureville for 30 years are now considering undertaking the same journey we are. Then this place must not be all that." Several in the group chuckled and Andrew smiled. "Now it's time to talk about the rest of your journey. When you leave tomorrow, you'll be traveling toward the Valley of Misery. As its name indicates, it is not a pleasant place. But it is vital that you successfully pass through that valley, because once you do, the City of Grace is not far from there." "Oh, that is wonderful news," said Mary.
"I can hardly wait," said Jody.
"What do we need to know about the Valley of Misery?" asked Rob. "The Valley of Misery is a lowland area surrounded by a nearly circular mountain range. The craggy peaks which encircle the plains are called the Mountain of Blame. The Village of Disappointment, along with the cities of Self-Pity, Grief and Regret, Bitterness and Resentment, Anger and Wrath, and the Hamlet of Hatred, all share the valley floor. It is a dreary place because dark clouds blanket the valley basin and the sun never breaks through. That place sounds worse than any of the cities we've passed through yet, said Mary. It does, Jody agreed.
You will probably find it to be so, Andrew replied.
The entrance to the Valley of Misery is through a narrow but alluring box canyon called Unforgiveness, continued Andrew. Many have been attracted to that canyon and hiked along the canyon trail, but most are unaware that the Canyon of Unforgiveness has a steep and sudden drop-off that plunges visitors to the valley floor before they ever realize what is happening. Most people who traverse Unforgiveness end up becoming residents in either the Village of Disappointment, the Hamlet of Hatred, or one of the valley's four other miserable cities. There's only one way of escape from the Valley of Misery. It requires negotiating a steep mountain pass called Forgiveness, which leads to a secret tunnel called Mercy. That tunnel burrows right through the mountains of blame and comes out into the sunlight on the other side. To leave the Valley of Misery, you will have to find the Mercy Tunnel. Many of the residents there do not even know it exists.
We will remember that, Timothy promised. Anything else we should know about the Valley of Misery? Stephen asked.
Well, you might find this interesting, Andrew offered. There are innumerable high places on the Mountains of Blame where all the residents of the Valley of Misery make pilgrimage. They bring offerings of blame to heap up on the mountain altars, blaming parents, children, ex-spouses, work supervisors, teachers, political leaders, and even themselves. The residents of the valley literally raise the elevation of the Mountains of Blame every year by the piles of blame they bring as offerings to the Idol of Misery.
Why would they worship the Idol of Misery, which I'm sure they hate? Ray asked.
Before Andrew could answer, Ben turned to his brother and said, "Probably the same reason everyone in trepidation worshiped the idol of fear, which we all hated. They probably feel like they are trapped and have no other choice."
"That is exactly correct," Andrew said.
"If you are able to show any residents of the Valley of Misery the way to forgiveness and mercy, they can escape misery too, but they will have to choose it." Andrew stood up. "I will leave you now so you can sleep. Safe journey to you all. I will see you on the other side of the Valley of Misery outside the Mercy Tunnel." He then walked out the front door of the bunkhouse into the moonless night. When morning came, Mr. Wood's knock and cheery "breakfast is ready" was a welcome wake-up call. After enjoying another hearty feast at Mrs. Wood's table and gratefully accepting her gift of packed lunches, the group was ready to leave. With many heartfelt farewells exchanged, the seekers set off to make their way toward the Valley of Misery. After 3 hours of steady hiking, the craggy peaks Andrew had described were looming before them. The road had slowly risen nearly 2,000 feet in elevation. A large road sign ahead featured an arrow and the words, "Valley of Misery, 1 mile." The road took a sharp turn to the right in the direction the arrow pointed. In less than 100 yards, the road ended at the entrance of the Box Canyon Andrew had told them about. A sign announced they had arrived at the Canyon of Unforgiveness. The canyon was narrow, and its sides were tall rock walls. Leafy green vines with small purple flowers grew along the walls, which gave it a more appealing appearance than its name belied. The trail through the narrow canyon looked fairly flat and not difficult to traverse. It was shaded from the sun and looked cool and inviting. "It might be a good time to stop for lunch before we make our way down into the Valley of Misery," Stephen suggested.
"I agree," said Timothy. "Who knows what we'll find there?"
"I think all of us worked up an appetite during this uphill climb," Mr. Rich said. "Since the canyon looks shady and cool, can we find a place to picnic inside the canyon walls?" Jody asked.
"Good idea," Stephen nodded.
The group walked into the canyon single file. The temperature dropped immediately by several degrees as the high walls shaded the seekers from the direct sun. About 50 yards into the canyon, the path widened and a stone table and benches lined one of the walls. It looked like a place many visitors had stopped to rest as they passed through the canyon. Names and dates were carved all over the walls, recording the visits of many travelers to the Canyon of Unforgiveness.
"This is perfect," Jody said as she lowered her knapsack to the table and began digging out the lunches Mrs. Woods had prepared.
As the food was distributed, Timothy stood staring at the wall of names and wondered aloud, "How many of these people do you think ended up trapped in the Valley of Misery after stopping here in Unforgiveness?"
I would hate to guess, Stephen answered. Not long after they began eating lunch, they heard footsteps in the canyon. Moments later, they spotted two men carrying large backpacks coming toward them. The men were professionally outfitted in hiking clothes and boots. Greetings were exchanged between the seekers and the two men. Then Mary asked, "Are you gentlemen hungry? Would you like to join us for lunch? We have plenty to share." The men stopped, and one pulled out a kerchief and wiped the sweat from his brow. "Thank you. That's mighty neighborly of you." "We have never been invited to share lunch with anyone in this canyon before," the second man said. "Please sit down and take a rest," Stephen invited. As the two men offloaded their heavy packs and sat down, Mary passed food to them. "What brings you here to this canyon? Are you headed to the Valley of Misery?" Timothy asked. "Yes, we are merchants, and we pass through this canyon and the valley once per month to bring our wares for sale." "Then you must know the secret of escaping this valley," Stephen said. "Oh, yes, we are very familiar with the Forgiveness Pass and the Mercy Tunnel," the taller man said. "What brings all of you here?" the shorter man asked Stephen. "We are just passing through, headed to the City of Grace," Stephen replied. "Then perhaps it is we who should ask you if you know the way to forgiveness and mercy. You do not want to be trapped in that valley. It is as miserable as its name implies," the tall man warned between bites of food. "If it is such a miserable place, why do you keep returning every month?" Ray asked the men. Both men shrugged, and the taller one answered, "Business is business. We just get in and out as quickly as possible." "Do you mind telling us about the towns in the Valley of Misery?" Stephen asked. "And about the people and why they would ever choose to settle there?" Ben added. "We both know people from our hometown of Independence who ended up living in the Valley of Misery," the shorter man told them. "We can tell you their stories and maybe that will answer your questions." "Please do," Timothy encouraged. "We would appreciate that." "Well, the one person I know who lives in the City of Bitterness and Resentment is my auntie," the tall man said. "She had a tragedy in her life that she never got over. She was widowed young, and her only child, a son, was killed in a freak accident. When he was 16 years old, my auntie decided to buy him a horse for his birthday. She asked the man who owned the horse to bring it to their ranch. When her son started to climb into the saddle, the horse bolted, galloping away at top speed. He could not control it as he was not fully in the saddle and didn't have the reins. The horse stopped suddenly and her son was thrown off. He hit his head on a rock and was killed instantly. My auntie blamed the owner of the horse. She was so angry and resentful toward everyone who tried to tell her it was just an accident and no one was to blame. A few years later, she heard about a group tour of the Canyon of Unforgiveness. It was advertised for people to meet up and socialize with others who felt justified in refusing to forgive someone who had wronged them. She signed up for the tour, which brought her here. As you know, the opening to the Canyon of Unforgiveness looks appealing, but what she didn't know was that it was a trap. Just then, the sound of people walking through the canyon caused everyone to turn to see who was coming. Stephen was shocked to see a demonic-looking creature pulling a long chain attached to a chain gang. The faces of his fellow seekers reflected the same horror he felt at the sight. One person after another was chained together, walking single file through the canyon. Their heads were down, and no one made eye contact. Not a word was spoken as they trudged past the table of seekers. The two merchants never looked up and just continued eating. A few moments later, after the chain gang was out of sight, the seekers heard blood-curdling screams. The group jumped at the sound, and Mary gripped Stephen's arm. What was that?" Jody cried. "That is the sound of those prisoners falling into the Valley of Misery," the tall man replied matter-of-factly. "When my auntie came here on that bogus tour, she didn't realize what she had gotten herself into. Everyone who refused to forgive was captured by that demon, chained and dragged to the edge of the canyon. At the end of the trail, there is a steep drop-off where unsuspecting travelers plummet to the valley floor. That is exactly how my auntie ended up in the Valley of Misery." "And she stayed there?" Ben asked. "Like everyone in that group, she was injured in the fall. She had to stay in the Valley of Misery to recuperate. but she ended up settling in the city of bitterness and resentment because she found others like herself there, the man replied. Can't you help her escape misery since you know the way out? Asked Mary. I have tried, but she told me plainly she won't have anything to do with leaving if it requires her to ascend the high paths of forgiveness or to get on her knees through the tunnel of mercy. Since there is no other way out of the valley of misery, she has decided to stay in bitterness until she dies. And that is so sad, said Mary. Stephen turned to the shorter man and asked, did the person you know in the valley of misery get trapped by that same demon we just saw? No, the short man answered, quite the contrary. My friend moved to the village of disappointment by his own choice, but I feel like it's my fault. How do you figure it was your fault? Rob asked. Because I told him about the place, the man lamented. My friend Pete was always a pessimist, even when we were kids. He could not look forward to any future event, regardless of how exciting it seemed to everyone else, because he always expected to be disappointed. When we graduated from high school and he applied for college, he was disappointed when he was not accepted. Then he started a business and it failed and he had to declare bankruptcy. He was engaged to his high school sweetheart, but she broke off the engagement right before the wedding. He basically experienced one disappointment after another, just like he expected. One day he was ranting about all the disappointments in his life, and I made the mistake of telling him he sounded just like the people I had met in the village of disappointment. So he said, well, if that is the case, maybe I should just move there. At least I'd be around people who know what it feels like to be disappointed and not around people like you who try to encourage me to believe in some fantasy of better times to come. And before long, I heard he had moved to the village of disappointment. Wow, that is a sad story too, said Jody. Everyone in the valley of misery has a sad story, the short man concluded. The tall man stood up. Are you people ready to move on? We can show you the way into the valley that avoids the plunge off the steep cliff, if you like, he said with a half smile. The group stood up, gathered their things, and began to follow the two merchants to the end of the canyon trail. It wasn't long before they approached the steep drop-off that had resulted in the frightening screams they heard less than 30 minutes before. This is the spot to avoid, the tall man said, but look over there to your left. Anchored to the canyon wall was a sturdy-looking iron ladder, which was partially obscured by leafy vines. The group followed the two men as they descended to the valley floor. Stephen chose to be the last one to descend the ladder and was amazed as he passed through a thick gray mist on the way to the bottom. It was just as Andrew had described to them. The valley of misery was covered by a heavy blanket of dark clouds. When Stephen reached the bottom of the ladder, he found himself stepping onto hard-packed ground. A highway stretched before him, and the group was assembled a few yards ahead, waiting for him. Where did the merchants go? Stephen inquired. They took off as soon as they hit the ground, saying they had to make their rounds of the cities, and they might catch up with us later, Ray said. Stephen frowned. Did they tell you how to find the Forgiveness Pass and the Mercy Tunnel so we can get out of here? They pointed in the general direction, Ben answered, but no specifics. That's not too helpful, Stephen muttered. We'll find our way, Timothy said with his usual encouraging smile. They did say that the main highway is a straight shot across the entire Valley of Misery and that we will pass through all six of its towns and cities. This should be interesting. After walking about 15 minutes, Stephen saw they were approaching entry gates. As they drew near, the words on a signboard above the gates became clear. It announced the Village of Disappointment. Below those words, they saw the town motto, I never get my hopes up because I'm always disappointed. A sentry held up his hand to stop the group and asked what they wanted. We would like to pass through your village as we're heading to the City of Grace, Stephen informed him. Ha! That journey will undoubtedly end in disappointment, but you'll see for yourselves, the glum-faced man commented as he swung open the gate. They walked down the highway through the center of the village. On the right side of the road was the neighborhood of disillusionment. Its streets were named Shattered Dreams, Unfulfilled Expectations, Let Down, and Dashed Hopes. On the left side was the neighborhood of discouragement. Its streets included frustration, failure, setback, adversity, and misfortune. Look at the names of those streets, Jody said, pointing toward the street signs. I wouldn't want to live on any of them. Not a very cheery place, that's for sure, her brother commented. There is nothing to be cheery about, a man's voice spoke up behind them. Stephen turned to see a sour-faced man with rumpled clothes and matted hair following them. Only two things you can be certain about in this life, the dejected-looking man continued. You will die, and you will be disappointed. So, there's no point in getting your hopes up. The group had stopped to listen to the man, but he never lifted his downcast eyes to look at them. You young people will discover that truth soon enough. It's inevitable, he pontificated as he trudged past them. Everyone was silent as they watched the man walk away. Then Ray whispered, This place kind of reminds me of our hometown. In what way? Ben asked. Gloomy, Ray replied quietly. Ben nodded. I see what you mean. It is kind of depressing. Let's get moving. We have a lot of ground to cover before we get out of this valley, Timothy reminded them. They left the village of disappointment, and before long they found themselves nearing the entrance to the city of self-pity. They stopped to read the sign above the gates. It read, Welcome to the city of self-pity. Poor me, I have it worse than anyone I know. These people don't sound any more pleasant than those living in the last town, Mr. Rich observed. Actually, they are even less pleasant, said a familiar voice. The group turned to find the two merchants they had met in the Canyon of Unforgiveness walking up behind them. Greetings were exchanged, and the tall man said, We can walk with you through self-pity as we are headed to the city of bitterness and resentment to do some business. It is the next city down the highway. Thanks, Stephen said. That would be good. There was no one guarding the gate to self-pity, so the travelers simply pushed the gate open and strolled in. What did you think of the village of disappointment? The short man asked as they walked. Depressing, Ray spoke up. Dreary, Mary added. In my opinion, self-pity's even worse, the tall man said. Why do you say that? Thomas asked. Did you notice the town motto on the entry sign? Yeah, it said something like, Poor me, I've had it worse than anyone. Close enough. The tall man nodded. These people think no one in the whole kingdom of Ai has experienced as much sorrow and unjust circumstances in life as they have. But truthfully, I think they are the most self-indulgent people I've ever met. In what way are they self-indulgent? Timothy asked. Not in the way most people indulge, not in food or alcohol. Their choice of indulgence is that of a continuous mental, emotional, and verbal gorging on their hardships in life. Every single day, they hold lengthy discourses with anyone who will listen and pour out their tale of woe without any restraint. I have been coming here for years, and I have heard the same stories over and over. They never stop. As they walked down the main street, there were an abundance of outdoor cafes where small groups of people were chatting. It was easy to overhear the loud and sometimes angry-sounding conversations. That's not nearly as bad as my situation. Don't feel so sorry for yourself. It could be much worse, like my life has been. You got off easy. What are you crying about? You don't even know what I've been through. The group walked past a table where a woman was sobbing inconsolably. It's even worse than I thought, she cried. Once they got to the outskirts of the city, the short man spoke. The first time I came here, I tried to sell some of my wares to a lady here in self-pity. She ended up telling me her sad tale, and I listened patiently. Then I tried to encourage her by pointing out a few bright spots I could see in her life. But her angry response shut me up, and I never wanted to sell anything to anyone here in self-pity again. What did she say? Stephen asked. When I tried to encourage her, she literally screamed, Easy for you to say. You have a great life, and you obviously don't understand what I've been through. At that moment, I realized she wasn't looking for encouragement at all, and neither is anyone else here in self-pity. They just want someone to agree with them that they are the most pitiable people in the kingdom of Ai. 30 minutes later, they neared the gates of bitterness and resentment. At the entrance, there stood a sign which read, Welcome to the city of bitterness and resentment. I was hurt, and I am bitter, and I have the right to be full of resentment. Another unpleasant-sounding place, commented Mr. Rich. Yes, quite true, agreed the tall man. This is where my auntie lives. Again, they found no one at the gate, so they walked into the city unhindered. A large fountain which gushed sparkling water into a large pool was the first thing the seekers noticed. The beautiful sound of the splashing water seemed to stand in stark contrast with the heavy atmosphere of the city. "Oh, that water looks refreshing," said Ray. "Let's get a drink." He began to stride toward the fountain when the tall man grabbed his arm. "You do not want to drink from that fountain," he said sternly. "Why not? The water looks great." "There is something altogether sinister about that water," the tall man insisted. "It is sweet to the taste, but bitter when it is swallowed. At first glance, the water looks refreshing, but in the end, it always leaves the drinker parched and thirsty. This fountain has snared many a passerby because it looks so appealing. But once a person drinks its bittersweet water, they are never satisfied. So they continue to drink in a vain attempt to quench their thirst. But after they drink for a while, they feel compelled to move to this city." Ray stepped back. "I definitely don't want that. Thanks for the warning." As the group moved down the roadway, Timothy asked the tall man a question. "What else can you tell us about this city and its inhabitants?" "The common denominator among the residents here seems to be they all have experienced some injustice, hurt, or trauma over which they became deeply embittered. While most are resentful toward a person they blame for their miserable condition, I've even met some who blame entire groups of people for their pain." "Does anyone ever escape this place once they move here?" Mary asked. "Well, I know of two cases. One left bitterness to move to anger and wrath, and the other moved straight to hatred." "That is hardly an escape," Mary said. "It sounds like they went from bad to worse." "That's true. Those two cities are miserable places as well," the tall man conceded. "You didn't tell them about the two who left the Valley of Misery altogether," the short man chided his companion. The tall man turned to him and answered, "That's because we don't know the end of that story yet." "What story is that?" Timothy inquired. "Well, it is something that happened very recently and caused a big uproar and bitterness. There was a married couple who moved here after their two children were killed in a school shooting a few years ago. About a month ago, they both claimed they had dreams about a king who called them to leave bitterness and come to his kingdom of love where their hearts would be healed. They even went down to the pool of bitterness to try to encourage others to go with them. They kept saying there was a better way of life than the hopelessness that bitterness offered them." "What happened? Did anyone go with them?" Stephen asked. "We were told that the people at the pool of bitterness started throwing stones at them to drive them away. But the couple kept shouting, 'Come to the city of seekers with us. You can have a better life than this if you meet the king.' But no one listened to them, and the couple left bitterness and the Valley of Misery, but we don't know what happened to them." "That is amazing," Stephen exclaimed. Looking perplexed, the short man asked, "Why do you say that?" "Because all of us in this group had dreams about the king calling us to his kingdom, and we have already traveled to the City of Seekers and received instructions to go to the City of Grace." "I thought they were imagining things," the tall man said. "But if all of you had similar dreams, maybe there's something to it." "I guarantee you there is something to it," said Stephen with a smile. "The City of Seekers is a real place where people can find out the truth about the Kingdom of Ai and also about the king and his kingdom." "If that is so, maybe my auntie could actually get out of this miserable place," the tall man said. "If she is willing to seek the king by traveling to City of Seekers, her entire life will change," Stephen encouraged. "I don't think she'd be willing to do that just because I told her so. Knowing her, she would have to have a dream herself," the tall man chuckled. "Well, what about you then?" Timothy asked. "I don't need anything. My life is fine. But I feel bad for her. She's so hopeless and bitter. I would like for her to get out of here." As the group continued walking down the road, the short man pointed to a group of people clustered around a putrid-looking pond. "There's the pool of bitterness we were talking about. It's a common pastime for residents to gather there daily. They rehash their past traumas and spew out the bitterness and angst they feel to anyone who will listen." The tall man added, "It is supposed to be therapeutic for them, but I can tell you that it never made my auntie feel any better. In fact, I'm convinced it drove her into a deeper emotional pit." "That doesn't look like a pool to me. It looks more like a swamp," Ray said, spying the greenish water. "It is nasty looking," Ben agreed. After passing the pool of bitterness, the seekers soon came upon a large neighborhood that had a sign proclaiming District of Silence. "What is that place about?" asked Thomas. The tall man stood staring at the sign for a moment and then answered, "There's a group of residents here in bitterness and resentment who never talk about their traumatic experiences. They live in this district called Silence. They refuse to speak of the past to anyone. Yet, from looking at their faces, I would guess their pain is as deep and excruciating as those who meet daily at the pool of bitterness. It is said that even their closest relatives and friends can't get them to talk about what they've been through. Many are war veterans, and most family members fear to ask them anything. We have customers in Silence, but it is like they are in prison and we are just handing them goods through the bars of their jail cells." "We are stopping here to do some business," a short man said. "I recommend you move as fast as you can through the next city on this highway, which is Anger and Wrath, as well as through the Hamlet of Hatred. Don't stop for any reason in those places. They can be dangerous. And one more piece of advice, don't argue or try to reason with anyone in anger or hatred. They are always waiting for an excuse to escalate a conflict, and you will never win." "That's good counsel. Thanks," Timothy said. "We can meet up with you in Grief and Regret," the tall man offered. "It's the last city you'll come to on this highway. I'm assuming you're planning to stay there overnight. Is that right?" Timothy and Stephen looked at each other and then at their watches. Stephen had lost track of time because they had never seen even a sliver of the sun all day due to the heavy cloud cover. He was surprised at the time. "It is getting late in the day, and I doubt we could negotiate the mountains of blame in the dark, so I think we have no other choice but to spend the night in Grief and Regret," Stephen said. "Okay, we will see you there. We always spend the night at the Inn of Loss. It is not an expensive place, but it is clean and has decent food, if you want to give it a try. It's located about halfway into the city on the right-hand side of the main road. You can't miss it," the tall man concluded. "Okay, thanks," Timothy said. "We will meet you there." The seekers left the city limits of bitterness and resentment and headed toward the city of anger and wrath. Stephen felt a heaviness in the air increasing as they walked. He was certain it wasn't just a result of the dark clouds. Something more ominous seemed to be enveloping them as they approached anger and wrath. The gates to the city were ugly and foreboding. A single guard dressed in a black uniform stood in a rigid, defensive stance, holding a weapon. As they drew near, the man let out a string of profanities before demanding, "What do you people think you're doing, trying to enter anger and wrath at this late hour?" The group of seekers stopped in their tracks. Timothy stepped forward and said politely, "Good afternoon, sir. Please forgive us for disturbing you, but we are requesting permission to pass through your city quickly as we are on the way to Grief and Regret to spend the night." "Forgive you, forgive you. Ha! We don't forgive anyone." The man let loose another volley of profanities before shouting, "Get on your way, but don't so much as stop to rest a moment in this city. Just get through it as fast as you can." With that, the guard opened the gates and the seekers darted through them without looking back. They walked as fast as possible down the main road, trying to put as much distance between themselves and the angry man at the gate. "Look at these street signs," Rob said. "They are as revealing as those we saw in the Village of Disappointment." He began to read each one aloud as he passed by. "Irritation, annoyance, aggravation, vexation, fury, rage." As he was reading the street names, an irate voice shouted, "You got a problem with our streets? Come over here and I'll show you a problem." "Say nothing more. Just keep moving quickly," Stephen said with a low voice. As the group increased their speed, the voice continued shouting, "Oh, so you're not only critics, you're cowards. Get over here and I'll show you what we mean by rage and fury." Suddenly, out of nowhere, missiles of rotten tomatoes, banana peels, and other trash began raining down on the group. At that point, the group started running. After a few blocks, when they were sure they had not been followed, the group slowed their pace. They remained silent as they walked, hoping they would not draw attention to themselves. Another voice shouted toward them out of the semi-darkness, "Hey, you! Grandpa, you gray hair, what are you doing here? Looking for the kids you abandoned? Feeling guilty for giving them a rejection complex? I know your kind. You remind me of my pops." "Who is he talking to?" Ben asked. I'm quite sure he's referring to me, Mr. Rich answered, since I am the only gray hair in this group. Don't ignore me, the voice shouted. You ignored your kids, and now they are angry at you too, and you know it. The voice seemed to be getting closer and escalating in its anger. In a moment, a wiry young man in his early 20s came into view, striding toward them. His face was beet red and his hands were clenched into fists. Do you have any idea what it does to someone when you make them feel like a reject? What it feels like when your own father rejects you? That is what my pops did to me, and you did it to your kids. And here you are. It's time you got a taste of your own medicine, the young man yelled. The seekers had stopped in the road and watched helplessly as the young man was stomping toward Mr. Rich. A soft answer turns away wrath, Timothy said. Remember, we read that in the King's Book the other night. Mr. Rich stepped forward. I am really sorry for what happened to you, for how your father treated you, Mr. Rich said gently. Sorry, sorry, is that all you can say? The enraged young man spewed. It hurt when he left us. The young man lunged at Mr. Rich and began pounding his fists on his chest. He was screaming, rejection hurts, I tell you. Timothy, Stephen, Thomas, and David all ran toward Mr. Rich to try to separate the two men, but Mr. Rich called them off. He had grabbed the young man's arms, and though he was still struggling and screaming, Mr. Rich was talking to him softly. The young man started sobbing and fell into Mr. Rich's arms. It was wrong for your father to abandon you. You are worth more than that. You are not a reject. There is a king, your creator, who loves you, and he's calling you to leave anger and wrath. Come to live in his kingdom of love. Stephen watched the scene in amazement. It had changed so quickly from being on the edge of danger to Mr. Rich's life and limb to something he could not explain. What are you doing to that young man? An angry voice demanded. More voices joined in. Yes, what are you doing? Who are you? How did you get here? The sound of a crowd marching in their direction startled the seekers. We need to get out of here quickly, Timothy said. Mr. Rich stepped away from the young man. He had composed himself by that point and turned to the voices. There is no problem here, the young man yelled out to the approaching crowd. He turned to Mr. Rich and said quietly, you need to move fast and head out of town or they will attack you. I was asking the same questions, he explained to the mob, but they are just passing through and on their way out of town. The seekers got away just before the crowd encircled the young man and began questioning him further. They ran as fast as possible and didn't stop until they exited the city limits of anger and wrath. Exhausted, the seekers slowed to a stop. Several bent over and tried to catch their breath. All dropped their bags and began brushing off the residue of the garbage that had assaulted them earlier. They rested for a few minutes, but it was getting darker by the minute. I know we are all tired, but I think we need to push ourselves to get past hatred. I don't want to be stuck there after dark. None of us want that, I'm sure, Mr. Rich agreed. Picking up their bags, they continued marching to the hamlet of hatred. It wasn't another 5 minutes before they saw the gates ahead. If there was a contest for ugly gates, hatred might just beat out the city of anger and wrath for the top prize, Ray commented. Ben shot a glance at his brother and said, you might not want to mention that opinion to its inhabitants. There were no guards at the gates of hatred. As they got closer, the gates began to open automatically. Did you notice that those gates looked like jaws opening, David observed. Yeah, kind of like a monster trying to swallow us up, Thomas said. That is not very encouraging, boys, Mary scolded. I doubt that we will find anything encouraging about this place. Let's just try to get through it as fast as possible, Stephen said. The streets were dark, and the few streetlights along the road were broken. Low-hanging dark clouds swirling in the evening breeze gave the town an eerie appearance. After they had walked a full block, they heard the sound of breaking glass. Through the open window of a dimly lit second-story apartment, they heard a loud argument ensuing. I hate you, a woman's voice screeched, followed by more glass breaking. Well, I wish you were dead, and the kids too, they're just like you, a man's voice roared. I'll kill you in your sleep and you'll never know what hit you, the woman's voice raged in reply. Something heavy crashed to the floor. "Do you think she's really going to kill him?" Jody asked, a look of distress on her face. "They've been doing that every night since they moved here," a woman's bored voice said. "This is just life as usual in the Hamlet of Hatred." Glancing in the direction of the voice, Stephen spotted a woman leaning against the building, smoking a cigarette. The sound of items crashing to the floor continued until the seekers were finally out of earshot. Two blocks later, they heard loud music and what sounded like a fist fight underway. As they passed by a saloon, the fight spilled out into the street. Men were throwing punches and others were being wrestled to the ground. Women came out of the bar and threw glass bottles at the scrapping men. The sound of men swearing at each other between landing vicious blows was fierce. "You're a dead man! You swine! I hate your filthy..." The fighting was so intense that no one seemed to notice the seekers as they skirted the battle that was now raging in the middle of the roadway. They hurried out of the town. "That was bizarre," Stephen said as they finally made it outside the Hamlet of Hatred. "I can't imagine what it would be like to live in such a place." "Quite miserable, I am sure," Mr. Rich replied, "and that may be an understatement." The group walked in silence for nearly half an hour, relieved to be distancing themselves from hatred. It was now completely dark, and they could see the lights of a city up ahead. As they approached, they could see that the gates were lighted and the sign above the entryway could be clearly read, "Welcome to the City of Grief and Regret. I am so devastated, I will never get over it." Stephen looked at the sign and thought it was elegant in a sad sort of way. The script used on the sign reminded him of a funeral program. There were two guards dressed in impeccably tailored uniforms who greeted the seekers. "To which borough are you headed?" one of the guards asked. "Excuse me," Stephen said. "We plan to spend the night in your city before leaving in the morning for the City of Grace." "That is fine," the guard replied, "but to which of our boroughs are you headed?" "Our fair city is divided into two major boroughs, one named Grief and the other is Regret. Where is it you are going?" "We are headed to the Inn of Loss," Stephen told him. "That is in the borough of Grief, and you can find it halfway through the city on the right-hand side of the road," the guard said as he began to open the gate. "We will show them the way," a cheery voice said from behind them. The group turned to see the two merchants walking up. Their backpacks looked considerably lighter than when they had last met. "We see that you made it successfully through anger and hatred," the short man said. "With our lives," Ray said. "It was a bit challenging," Ben added. "Mr. Rich got physically attacked by a crazy guy in anger and wrath," Ray told them. "We all survived it," Mr. Rich reassured them. As they walked through the Borough of Grief, Timothy asked the tall man to tell them about the city. "This place is a bit different than other cities in the Valley of Misery. In a way, it is like there are two completely different populations that live here." "How do you mean?" Timothy asked. "There's a big difference between those who live in grief and those who live in regret. Everyone in the Borough of Grief share one thing in common. They all have experienced some devastating loss. Some have lost a child. A lot of them have lost a spouse. Others still a parent, sibling, or close friend. There's also a large group who lost a business or a position in life and are grieving deeply over that. Their sorrow is so intense that the atmosphere of the city is thick with its heaviness. You'll notice this in the morning when it's light and you can see clearly, but everyone in grief moves like they are in slow motion, and they get deeply offended if anyone suggests they should move faster. But that is not the only thing you will notice," the shorter man added. "The residents of grief are known for muttering to themselves, especially the newcomers. They're often seen walking around in a daze saying things like, 'I can't believe this happened. I can't believe he's gone.' Others who have lived in grief longer can be found wandering the hills mumbling, 'My life is over. I can't move on. I have nothing to live for.'" "You should tell them about the swamp," the tall man added. "What swamp?" Ray asked. The short man smiled. "In the southern part of the city, there's a large swamp named Y. On any given day, multitudes of the residents of grief can be found circling the edge of the slough, crying out inconsolably, 'Why? Why? Why? Why did this have to happen?' Marching around the swamp of Y seems to have an almost hypnotic effect on those who trudge there. It is rumored that those who stay for long periods of time often slip on the slimy shore into the murky swamp waters and are never heard from again. But that's just a rumor. Now, the people who live in the Burrow of Regret are a different story altogether, the tall man began. They are equally heavy-hearted souls, but they are filled with self-recriminations. The Burrow of Regret has two neighborhoods named Done and Undone. The first neighborhood houses the people who regret things they have done during their lifetimes. The second is populated by those who regret what they've left undone. What exactly does that mean? Thomas asked. The tall man smiled. Stay with me. It'll make sense in a moment. The neighborhood of Dunn has streets that are named after the very things the residents regret. And the citizens of Regret intentionally punish themselves by choosing to live on the street, which daily reminds them of their failures. For example, Divorce Highway is crowded with inhabitants who regret the breakups of their marriages. Abortion Avenue is another densely populated road where sorrowful wails can be heard any time of the day or night. Other densely populated streets in the neighborhood of Dunn include adultery, immorality, and child abuse. Okay, that makes sense to me, but I don't understand what you mean by undone. Who lives in that neighborhood? In the neighborhood called Undone, there are many streets, but one prime example is the street named Absentee Father. It is also one of the most crowded. Men who never cultivated a relationship with the children they fathered feel guilty about what they did not do for their children. What they don't know is that small demons of shame and guilt have been following them since the day they arrived in the City of Grief and Regret. The demons whip them daily with invisible whips that cause the pangs of guilt and shame they experience. Every time a pang of guilt or shame plagues them, they feel obliged to bring an offering to the altar. What altar is that? Thomas asks. It's the altar of guilt and shame located in the center of the city, the tall man replied. Here is the inn where we're staying overnight, the short man said as he pointed to a low-slung building. The group walked up the two steps leading into the small lobby of the Inn of Loss. It was a dreary-looking place with shabby furniture, and Stephen noticed no one had dusted the place in years. He hoped the rooms were cleaner than the lobby. The seekers were completely exhausted after such a long and intense day. After a quick bite to eat in the inn's small dining room, they all headed to their rooms to sleep. Stephen was sharing a room with Mr. Rich that night. He was glad because he wanted to ask him how he was doing after the disturbing incident in the City of Anger and Wrath. Stephen noticed he had been more quiet than usual all evening. As they got settled for the night, Stephen asked, "How are you doing after that crazy attack this afternoon?" "I feel fine. That young man didn't hurt me, at least not physically," Mr. Rich answered. "Okay, not physically, but what about emotionally? He said some ugly things." "Yes, he said some ugly things, but they were true things, and that did hurt me. I don't know how he knew those things about me, or if he was just guessing that I was like his own father, but the truth is, that really shook me. Talk about regrets. I was such a failure as a father that I feel like I should move to this city and live in the Burrow of Regret because I have so many of them." "But what about those things you said to him that deflated his angry tirade? That was so insightful. It's like you knew what he needed to hear," Stephen said, trying desperately to encourage him. "I only said what I wish I could say to my own children to try to take away the pain I caused them," Mr. Rich said as he leaned back on a pillow and closed his eyes. "But they won't even speak to me. I should really settle in regret. I don't deserve to continue this journey to see the king." "None of us deserve to meet the king," Stephen replied, "and yet he still called each one of us. You need to remember what he said to you in your dream." Exhausted after the day's events, both men fell into a deep sleep. When Stephen woke up in the morning, Mr. Rich was already awake and fully dressed. He was sitting on the edge of his bed, smiling, as if he had been waiting for Stephen to awaken.
Stephen rubbed his eyes and then squinted at the smiling figure of Mr. Rich. He sat up and asked, "You look awful happy this morning. What's up?"
"I had another dream about the king," Mr. Rich gushed.
Stephen smiled. How kind is this king we are seeking, Stephen thought, remembering his own dream in the City of Ambition that helped him remain on this journey to the City of Grace. "Please tell me about it."
"I saw the king walking on the road here in the City of Grief and Regret. He called my name. He said, 'Rick, why do you want to live in regret when I have invited you to live with me in my kingdom?' I answered him and said, 'I don't deserve to live in your beautiful city. I've made too many mistakes in my life and hurt many people, including my own children.' He replied, 'That is true, but my son paid the price for your acceptance into the kingdom of I Am with his life. Don't refuse his gift of love and mercy. I am waiting for you.' Then I woke up." Stephen shook his head in amazement. That dream was a real gift from the king. "Yes, it was. It answered the questions of my heart. I needed that very desperately," Mr. Rich said.
"I am so glad to know you will continue with us to the City of Grace," Stephen said with a broad smile. As the group ate breakfast in the dining room, Timothy and Stephen grilled the two merchants on the directions to the Forgiveness Pass and the Mercy Tunnel. The two men had made it clear that they couldn't wait for the group, but needed to hurry out of the Valley of Misery because they were behind schedule. "Is there anything else we need to know to be able to successfully exit this valley?" Timothy asked them.
"Yes, there is something important you need to know. It may sound strange, but it is true," the tall man said solemnly.
"What is it?"
"When you are ascending the Forgiveness Pass, if you or any of the members of your party start having trouble breathing and feel like you cannot go on, there is something you need to do. You need to ask them if there's anyone in their life they have not forgiven. An old man once told me that no one can ascend the Forgiveness Pass with unforgiveness in his heart. So we have learned to take inventory of our own minds and hearts every time we travel through here so that we are not hindered on the journey. I have watched many people try to get out of the Valley of Misery who refused to forgive, but they could never escape," the tall man said.
"There's one more thing," the short man added. "When you get to the Mercy Tunnel, you will have to bow down and get on your knees. It's very humbling, but you'll never get through it without doing so. And if you or anyone in your party is struggling to get on their knees, ask them if they can promise to show mercy to the person they have forgiven. If they can, then they will suddenly find the strength to kneel and crawl through the Mercy Tunnel. I know all of that sounds very odd, but these are two tricks that the old man taught me many years ago, and it works every time," the tall man explained. "Now we need to be on our way. We wish you success on your journey." The two men picked up their backpacks, and with a wave, they were gone. After gathering their bags, the group began to walk up the path leading through the Mountains of Blame. It was a long, slow hike, with the elevation increasing as the path wound up the mountains. Suddenly, Mary started having trouble breathing. She was wheezing and short of breath.
"I need to stop for a few minutes to catch my breath," she said.
Stephen and Timothy looked at each other and nodded. They walked over to Mary, and Timothy spoke to her quietly.
"Mary, I know this may sound strange, like a strange question, but it's important. Is there anyone in your life that you have not forgiven? Maybe for something they did that hurt you or disappointed you? We were told that no one can ascend the Forgiveness Pass without forgiveness in their heart. That is why I'm asking you this question." Mary's eyes widened as she stared at Timothy.
I don't know," Mary sputtered.
"Are you sure?" Timothy prodded gently.
"Okay, yes, my sister Martha. I am so mad at her for not coming on this journey with me."
Tears began to well up in her eyes.
"Okay, that's good. Now you just need to forgive her," Stephen said gently.
"How can I?" Mary asked, tears streaming down her face.
"Just imagine if it was you that stayed behind and she left. Would you want her to forgive you for not accompanying her? Yes, of course, that's right, I would. Okay, I can do this. I forgive Martha for not coming on this journey, she said with conviction. Good. Now, start taking deep breaths, Timothy instructed. After a few moments, Mary said with excitement, I can breathe easier. Stephen and Timothy grinned. Wow, that really is the key, Stephen said. The group continued walking up the mountain path. It wasn't long before both Ray and Ben were struggling with shortness of breath and needed to stop. Stephen encouraged everyone to take a rest break to sit down. Then he and Timothy explained everything the two merchants had told them about successfully scaling the forgiveness pass. They told them about the secret of forgiveness. Mary shared how her ability to breathe freely was restored after she forgave her sister. Then Timothy asked everyone to search their hearts to see if there was anyone in their life that they had not forgiven. One by one, the seekers confessed the unforgiveness that came to mind. Many of them had to forgive parents and other relatives, and Mr. Rich realized he needed to forgive his two ex-wives. When they continued their hike, they found themselves easily progressing along the trail, and no one was struggling to breathe the cool mountain air. As they got closer to the peaks of the Mountains of Blame, they found that the trail was becoming narrower. Then they reached a place where there had been a landslide, and nothing remained but a pile, massive pile of rocks. The trail was gone. They all stood there stunned. There appeared to be no way to go forward. How will we ever get out of this valley if the mountain pass is blocked? Ray asked. Perhaps this is where we search for the Mercy Tunnel. Why else would we need to go through a tunnel unless the pass was unpassable? Mr. Rich suggested. That's it, exclaimed Timothy. You must be right. I read something in the King's book last night. It said, he who follows mercy finds life. Let's find that tunnel. All the seekers began searching the area until suddenly they heard David shout, I found it. It's over here. The group gathered around him a few yards off the trail. There in the side of the mountain was a tunnel carved through the rock. It had been covered with some leafy vines, but David had pushed them aside, revealing a small sign over the opening. It read, Mercy Tunnel. The tunnel was not big enough to walk into, and anyone who wanted to get through it would have to get down on his knees. Can we really crawl through that tunnel without getting stuck along the way? Rob asked, eyeing the narrow tunnel with skepticism. I am glad you asked, because that reminds me of something one of the merchants told us, Stephen said. He said if anyone struggled to get on their knees to crawl through the tunnel, they should consider whether they are willing to extend mercy to the ones they needed to forgive. Extending mercy will give you the power to travel through the Mercy Tunnel. I'm not sure I understand how that works, but I think I understand, Mr. Rich interjected. Last night, I was feeling like I should stay in the City of Regret because of all my failures with my children. I felt like I didn't deserve to go to the King's beautiful city. Then I had this amazing dream. The King spoke to me and said, though it was true that I had made all those mistakes, he was still inviting me to live in his kingdom. When I woke up, I had this overwhelming appreciation for his mercy, and it made me want to be merciful to those who had hurt me, including my two ex-wives. I want them to receive the King's mercy as well. So I think the reason we all have to decide if we're willing to extend mercy to others in order to get through the Mercy Tunnel is because mercy is part of the King's nature, and he wants us to act like him. The seeker stared at Mr. Rich for a few minutes without responding to his statement. Well, if that is not a revelation, I don't know what is, Timothy said. I guess the question we all need to ask ourselves is this. Are we willing to show mercy to those who have hurt us? And do we desire to see them receive the same mercy the King has extended to us? One by one, the seekers answered in the affirmative. Then I believe we can all successfully navigate the Mercy Tunnel without any difficulty, Stephen said with confidence. Rob, why don't you be the first to try it? Rob agreed. He knelt down and began to crawl through the tunnel easily. His sister Jody followed him, and Mary went after them. Then Ben and Ray followed the girls, and the other two brothers, Thomas and David, entered and quickly were out of sight.
Mr. Rich was next, followed by Timothy. Then lastly, Stephen climbed into the tunnel and made his way slowly to the other side. When Stephen climbed out of the tunnel, he found the sunlight almost blinding. The dreariness of the Valley of Misery was a stark contrast to the bright midday sun. When he got acclimated to the light, he saw the seekers gathered around their friend, Andrew the Encourager. To Stephen, that sight was a reward in itself. Andrew was beaming as he looked at Stephen. "Congratulations, Stephen. This is a joyous occasion. You escaped the Valley of Misery and discovered the importance of both forgiveness and mercy." "Yes," answered Stephen. "Thanks to the King, we all made it."